Shrink Wrap Radio number 500, Enhancing Your Baby's Development Through Movement, with Beverly Stokes.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Beverly Stokes, who is a certified movement analyst and author. She is acknowledged as a leader in the field of developmental movement education and nonverbal communication. For more information about Beverly Stokes, please see our show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Hey everyone, this week's featured article in The Neuropsychotherapist is Spirituality as Connectedness, by neuroscientist Richard Hill. You'll find it at neuropsychotherapist.com, which is the beautifully illustrated online monthly magazine for psychotherapists and anyone else interested in the intersection between the latest neuroscience findings and psychotherapy. I want you to go to neuropsychotherapist.com and get your free introductory issue today. And I'm hoping that will inspire you to support their superlative work by subscribing to it. Now, here's today's interview. Beverly Stokes, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. I'm delighted to be here today.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you on the show, I must say. You're the author of two very fascinating titles. One is Amazing Babies Moving, Essential Movement to Enhance Your Baby's Development in the First Year. And then you have a more recent one that just came out in 2015, and it's titled Your Self-Motivated Baby, Enhance Your Baby's Social and Cognitive Development in the First 6 Months Through Movement. So you're really into babies.
I am.
Well, before we get into your work as it's presented in these two books, let's take a step back and have you tell us how you first got interested in infant development.
Well, I was teaching a movement program for adults and teens and a mums and tots class in Canada. And I just decided I really wanted to know more. I was so fascinated by the baby's movements. So I trained with Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen at her school for body mind centering in Amherst, and became certified in that work as a practitioner and teacher, and basically focused on the developmental movements and experiential anatomy. But I also was interested in going into private practice. So I trained as a cranial sacral therapist.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes, and had a studio in Toronto that we called the Center for Experiential Learning. I had a large movement studio and ran my parent baby groups there.
You're reminding me to move.
Right. So that was an important part of my work.
Yeah.
I also developed the, originated the movement program at the Ontario College of Naturopathic Medicine and taught developmental movement program there and experiential anatomy. I was at the same time in private practice at my studio, and that is where I documented Amazing Babies Moving, my first video. Later on, as I had a private practice and I was teaching programs and developing workshops, I also continued my own work. And I met Janet Kalo, and I was on faculty at her program in her Laban-Bartenieff and Somatic Studies program in Canada. And that was at York University and Ryerson University. And as I was teaching, I was also interested in following up on other movement modalities, and I became interested in studying with Warren Lamb, who focused on pre-verbal communication.
So, wow, you have been doing pioneering work for in infant development now for 25 years, and I'm struck by how you have carved out a career for yourself in a very non-traditional way. You didn't just go into a master's program here or a doctoral program there, but really you've kind of invented your own career, your own niche, which I really congratulate you on.
Thank you.
and you've been doing it for 25 years.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if you can kind of, in broad strokes, contrast for us what was known about infants 25 years ago when you first got into this, and a sense of what's changed over the course of 25 years. And I know we'll get into some of the specifics of that as you take us through some of your current work, but kind of in broad strokes, I assume we know a lot more now than we did then.
Well, yes, and I think that many researchers are becoming, for some reason, I think motor development fell out of fashion or something, but researchers are very much more interested in motor development now, and I think that is different. However, what is unique about the work I'm doing is I'm looking at the babies in real time. And that is quite significant. I can't ask the babies, you know, to do something, or you can't ask a baby a question, you know. Really, it's the baby who is going to lead the whole session. So I think basically, there's more interest now in motor development or movement development, and also in pre-verbal communication, in social interaction with babies. What is probably newer is looking at decision-making in babies, at the baby's motivation.
I think a lot going on with babies.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, you were trained in cranial sacral and other kinds of movement. So are you manipulating the babies in any way? Are you massaging them or stretching their limbs or anything like that?
I'm glad you brought that up. Actually, no. At that time, I mean, this was a while ago when I was in private practice that I was trained in cranial sacral therapy and hands-on work. But I think that's what is also unique about my work is that I do not move the babies. I set up a situation, an environment. What's really important is to create the environment for the babies to move. Even in my baby groups, or if I'm teaching a parenting class, the parents may walk around the room holding the baby, singing to the baby, humming, vocalizing, but I don't move the baby's limbs because what I'm interested in is how the baby organizes their body by themselves. So it has to be that we're set up a situation, a playful situation, where the baby is enjoying moving. And also that brings me to documenting the baby in these positions, so not having the baby sit on the mom's lap, but lying on the floor.
Yeah, and you've got all these wonderful pictures in your latest book, and we'll be talking about those situations.
Yeah.
And but it made me wish that there were an infant in the house. Now, I'm the father of four and grandfather now of four.
Yeah.
But everybody's past the baby stage.
Mm-hmm.
And while I'd like to think I was a good father, I certainly didn't know as much as I do now, having gone through your books. And it seemed like a really key thing is, as you just said, getting down on the floor at the baby's level.
Yes.
And and not doing something to them, but really letting them lead the situation, and they're learning about us and we're learning about them, and it's a very fluid exchange is the impression I've got.
Absolutely. And another thing in creating an environment, a home environment for the baby, is that to make sure that the baby is rested, dry, fed, and alert. Yeah. And when the baby is kind of in the optimal state, then allowing the baby to be on the floor and the parent or parents or siblings be at the baby's level, which is so important. And then, you know, the baby knows you're there. If the baby begins exploring with a toy or an object, then it's nice if the parent allows this uninterrupted play for the baby and to observe what their baby can do. And the baby will show them so many amazing explorations that they're involved in, or actions. You know, they're eager to move.
Yeah,
They love moving their own body.
Right.
And so, just like we do, you know, at the end of the day, if I want to go for a swim, and you really, just the pleasure of moving, going for a walk, going for a swim. I like dancing as well.
Good
so
for
I
you.
Dance tango.
Oh, really? Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Argentine
tango.
Somebody started talking about that just yesterday in my Tai Chi class.
Uh-huh.
So interesting that the very next day we're talking about Argentine tango.
I only mention it because of the pleasure of moving, and that babies are so eager to move and explore.
And you're going to be painting verbal pictures for us, since people don't have the book, unfortunately, yet. to be looking at these photos. So you'll be kind of painting the picture for us, describing some, as you call them, vignettes of kind of sessions or action sequences.
Yeah.
And we're going to have you take us through a movement framework which focuses on developmental movement, social interaction, and self-motivated learning. So we'll take some time and have you step us through each of these three topics, if you will.
Yeah.
So let's jump into it now.
Okay.
With
developmental movement.
Yeah, developmental movement.
Everything is about movement. Even the social interaction is expressive. There's functional movement and expressive movement, and the actions and self-motivated learning. But basically, I begin with developmental movement because of the changes that occur during the first year. And these milestones, the baby lifting their head, rolling over, belly crawling, you know, coming to independent sitting, cross-lateral creeping, pulling up to standing, and independent walking, during that time that is over primarily the first year, we see four patterns of movement. And I show this in my first book. In my second book, we only cover the first three patterns because we're just looking at the first 6 months. But these patterns are spinal movement, initiated from the head and tail, symmetrical movement, initiated by both arms or both legs, lateral movements initiated by the movement of the arm and leg on the same side of the body, and cross-lateral movements, and this is the one that you see in locomotion and the hands and knees creeping, is the movement of the right arm and left leg together and the left arm and the right leg together.
Now, I seem to recall that one of the grandchildren, when they were kind of in this phase, did the creeping, but backward, ended up going backward. Is that something that happens some of the time?
Well, yes, but not in the cross-lateral creeping, although they can creep backwards maybe to get out of the way. But maybe that's, you're talking about one of the first locomotion patterns where a baby's lying on the floor on their tummy and they push with both hands and their body slides backward.
Okay, and, yeah, I don't remember it all that clearly, but that's probably what was going on.
But that's probably what's happened. It's really a protective response, but it's also very funny for the baby because they may be intending to go forward to a parent or to get a toy, and all of a sudden they're sliding backwards. They really do find that very funny.
Yeah, and I'm struck by how closely you observe them and how you've created a whole vocabulary, as we were just hearing, for describing and categorizing their movements.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what's going on? What sorts of things are they learning in the course of doing all this movement?
Well, yes, what really interested me is how babies move in different body positions. So a baby lying on its back, what is the baby exploring? We could look at a three-month-old and see the baby bringing their hands together. Their head is in midline. They bring their feet together. Maybe they're exploring their hands and developing their body awareness. And, you know, I always encourage the parents to talk to their babies about their body. You know, they come in, they say, "Oh, I see you found your hands today." You know, or "I see you found your knees today. And maybe a four-month-old baby is lifting their legs off the floor and placing their hands on their knees. "Oh, you've got your toes today." So during this pre-locomotion stage, babies are developing their body awareness and doing all of these incredible explorations against the potent force of gravity, because they are moving against gravity.
So they're learning about gravity, among other things, as well.
Absolutely.
And it's funny, as you lean into the camera and speak to me in that lovely voice that you would speak to the baby, and I see your lovely face, it makes me aware of my fingers and my toes. I feel like I'm regressing.
No. I think you're just developing your tactile awareness and your kinesthetic awareness as I'm talking.
Yeah.
So
somebody might wonder, well, what's the point of all of this? I mean, the baby will develop, and, you know, what's the point of knowing all of this?
Well, it's not just a matter of knowing. It's the baby's motivation to explore, interact in social interaction, lead their social interactions, and to develop their motivation in problem solving, in actions, new actions. And these vignettes that I show how long a baby can explore and what they are learning. It's very different for, say, I was talking about 3 months. So let me talk about the three-month-old baby exploring her toy whale. She's lying on the floor. Okay. She has the mother gives her a little toy whale, stuffed toy. It's quite large, but she can rest it on her body, and she can turn it around and hold the tips of the tail. She may see the tag. You know, babies love tags on toys. And she points to the tag, even at 3 months. And she moves this toy around and feels the toy. And then the toy lands on the floor beside her. Now, the toy has a curve in the tail. And she turns her hand and curls her fingers and moves the back of her hand into the same shape of the whale's tail.
Uh-huh, so she's kind of mirroring it.
She recognizes that her own hand, she can shape her own hand and fit it into the shape, the three-dimensional shape of the whale.
Interesting, yeah.
Very interesting. So, you know, that is three-dimensional learning, and she is the one that is creating that exploration. As I observed her and watched her continue her exploration, her, she also, when she had the whale on her body, was able to support the whale with one leg. So she's very aware of what she can do. And at the end of the session, she is relaxed, her arms are relaxed, her body is relaxed, she has her hand on the head of the whale, and she's very calm. And okay. This is a very long learning, exploration experience, led by her.
That seems to be a really key thing, and I notice you say that with particular emphasis. So say a little bit more, why is it important that it's led by her?
Because they are learning what they can do. And so often we think we have to teach babies.
Yeah.
You know, what we're the ones that are going to be the teachers, but we're
right.
not. The babies are going to teach us. And what was interesting to me was a four-month-old baby. I was documenting, I was photographing her. She was lying on the floor on her back. And when I looked at her, she was looking at me, and her arm was spread to the side, and her index finger was pointing to the stars on her blanket. And I thought, she wants me to look at the stars on her blanket. She's sharing her experience with me.
Uh-huh.
And that's called declarative pointing. Pointing something to share something with somebody else.
Uh-huh.
Which is, different.
And that was at what age?
4 months old.
4 months.
So, but you see, you wouldn't think that you would see the pointing gesture in a baby that young. The interesting thing is she is lying on her back on the floor. She's not sitting yet, but in that supported position with her arms supported on the floor, she can communicate and use this pointing gesture, and through her visual intention to engage me, look at me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do I know this? I know her intention was that because of what she did next.
What was that?
And that was she wanted to roll over and touch a large star on her blanket, because this blanket had clusters of small stars, white stars in a blue background, large stars, and medium-sized stars, and she rolls over to point to the large star on her blanket, and eventually she rolls right on top of the star.
Okay, so, but you didn't reach out and roll her over when you got that intention from her.
No, not at all.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, in tummy time, in this case too, she rolls over onto her tummy. She gets her one hand caught underneath her.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
You've seen that, and often a parent will try and help the baby to move their hand, but I usually encourage the parent again, let the baby organize their body by themselves.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of what's going on, it sounds like, is the baby's developing a sense of self-efficacy, that
yes.
the baby's learning, I can do.
I can do, yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so kind of going back to my earlier question of what's the point of all this, I know a lot of parents are interested in, now I'm going to block on the word, sort of an enhanced, stimulating environment.
Okay. Yes, yes.
Enrichment, that's the word.
Enriched environment.
Enriched environment. And in a way, this is a way of enriching the baby's environment in a very social way, so that there would be a lot of social learning going on.
Yes, yes. And also, what's interesting is letting the baby take the lead in these social interactions. And I want to share a really wonderful development in babies around 5 months old. They're developing a sense of humor.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and they are very funny. I write actually about one baby in my first book, but this baby is 10 months old, and it was in a baby group, and one baby sitting behind the other. The little boy in front has a big beach, a colorful beach ball, and he lifts the ball over his head, and the baby behind sees the ball coming, and she takes the ball, and she kind of is playing a joke on him behind, literally behind his back.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's great.
He looks so surprised, and then he smiles. He gets the joke. Well, at 5 months, I'm actually interacting with a five-month-old baby on the floor, and somebody else is documenting it. And we're lying facing each other in tummy time with our arms resting on the floor, our fingertips close to each other. And she looks at my right hand, and she places her left hand, mirroring my hand, on my right hand. And then she looks, I have a colorful necklace on, she looks at that, but she looks back at our hands. So there's a little time passing here, and I'm not doing anything. I'm not saying anything, I'm just observing what she's doing. And then she looks up at me, and I smile at her. So I let her know, I'm enjoying what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But I still don't say anything, and I don't do anything. And then she looks at me and smiles, and now we're smiling together. So we're, you know, really saying to each other, we're enjoying this. And she looks back at our hands, and she takes her left hand and crosses our midline and puts her hand on my left hand. And she's watching me to see what I'm doing. But I don't know what she's going to do next, and I'm really curious. I don't know what her repertoire is at 5 months. And then she pulls her hand away quickly, and she looks at me and laughs, and her whole body extends, and that's the joke. That's the physical joke. You know, and aren't so many comedic actions based on quick timing?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a surprise.
We had twins, actually, and two of our four kids were twin boys, and fraternal twins. Uh-huh. And I remember they were on the kitchen table in those little stand-up, I don't know, baby seats. I don't know, plastic.
Now, we don't want to talk too much about containers, but it'd be better to have them on the floor.
Yeah, okay, good point. Yeah. But what this did was they were kind of facing each other, and it seemed like it was almost the first time that they realized that there was another guy there, and they started laughing. And their laughter just kind of triggered each other, and they're just there laughing at each other,
and
a real sense of joy and discovery.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Can I say something about the containers and especially overuse of containers?
Sure.
Because it is, you know, a bit of an issue with children being put in containers a lot and not getting the physical activity of moving on the floor and developing all these amazing movements that they do, as well as their motivation to explore the environment.
Yeah, okay. I think in this case it was for feeding and with two, and, you know,
have
some way of setting them up, but yes. Now, earlier I noticed you said something about curiosity, and it seems like that's important, that what you're bringing to the situation is a lot of your own curiosity.
Yeah. Well, that's what, I mean, it's our interest and it's these three stages of the decision-making framework. The attention stage where the baby expresses their focus of attention. They're gazing, they're looking, they're showing their interest, their curiosity. Maybe they now have the toy that they're going to play with. And then the second stage, their action planning, you know, what are they going to do with this toy? How is this exploration going to unfold? And the third stage is the action stage, and these are all the different actions that the baby will, you know, do with the toy. What's interesting in these long vignettes, and one that I also show a baby playing with a wooden duck at 5 months, is that the toy is given to them. That's the participation of the adult. So the parent or whoever is with the baby sets up the environment with a toy. But you can't tell the baby again how to explore the toy. So it really then is the baby's interest in going further with the toy and how they're and developing their handling skills. Now, sometimes a surprising event will happen. And this five-month-old with this wooden duck was on two wheels, so it was a little unstable, had a wooden ring around it, and the duck turns over. So now the duck is upside down. And the baby has another problem to solve if she has an intention in mind to maybe do something else, as we will see, when the duck is right side up. So now, but first she has to turn the duck right side up. And she does this, and this wooden ring is around the duck, fits into the curve of her arm. And again, it's this three-dimensional space and relationship of the toy to the, which is circular, that goes into the curve of her arm, just like that three-month-old putting her back of her hand into the curve of the baby of the whale's tail. So there's an embodiment, there's an understanding of the of three-dimensional action and space and a three-dimensional toy.
You know, earlier you were describing a situation with the baby, and you said, and I didn't say anything.
Right.
So when do you say things? When do you know the time is right to say, to be talking to your baby?
Well, that's important because I'm kind of talking about two or several different ways of interacting with babies.
Yeah.
One is the very social. And they're, you know, beginning very early. The baby is looking at the mother's face. The mother's face is very animated. She may be talking, singing, you know, humming. You know, so her mouth is moving, and the and her eyes are bright. Maybe her eyebrows are raised. The baby's looking into her eyes. Maybe shifts the gaze to the mouth. You know, so there's that kind of very rich engagement and social interaction that's taking place between the parent or the adult and the baby. The other explorations that I'm talking about in the play interaction with the baby is different. And sometimes parents will think they have to show the baby how to play and do something. But if your baby's engaged, really, that's when you want to observe how what the baby is doing. The baby's very aware that you're there. Your participation, being there, is very important. We all know, I mean, maybe you've had this experience of trying to solve a problem and you have a friend and your friend's just there and really not saying anything. But just because there's someone else and you're talking out this problem,
right,
you have an aha experience and you solve the problem.
Yeah.
Well, it's a similar thing. The parent is there, the adult is there and your attention is on the baby. So that's a very important part.
Yeah.
It's unstructured play. You know, it's a way, in a way, unstructured.
Yeah. We all crave an attention, like being a podcaster. I can attest to that. And yeah. I can even remember when I was quite young, it was constantly, Mommy, look at this. Look at what I can do. Mommy, look. And that almost goes through the whole life cycle, but it kind of gets converted into other people eventually.
Well, but no, it's actually happening right here, because the baby is wanting you to observe what they're doing. And at the end of an exploration, I have several where I show the baby smiling. Now, sometimes the baby is just smiling at what they have done, the pleasure in play, mm-hmm. or if the parent is there, the baby may look up at the parent with bright eyes and smile because they know they've been watching and seeing what they can do. So that's not really that different, except it's the baby, you know, isn't saying, look at what I can do. The baby, right?
Yeah.
It's a game. A baby can't say that.
Yeah. I'm just saying that goes on through our whole life cycle, that, you know, we all crave being seen.
Yes.
And there, in psychology, there's a concept of social facilitation that I remember from graduate school a long time ago, that two animals will eat more side by side than they will alone.
Yes.
Quite a few different species, including human beings. But we really didn't talk about, I had asked you about when to talk to your baby. And so there are occasions where I think you, and mothers kind of naturally do this, if the baby is making some kinds of sounds.
Well, I have a really an interesting experience with a mom and baby I was documenting. The baby was about 2 months old. And so I said to her, you know, is your baby looking at you? And did I say 2 months old?
Yes.
No, 2 weeks old.
Oh, wow.
I'm sorry. The baby's 2 weeks old. 10 days, 2 weeks, around that time frame. And she said, oh, no, my baby really can't focus on my face yet. You know, he's not really looking at me. So I said, you know what, hold your baby in your arms and stand up, and I'm going to videotape your baby over your shoulders. So she held her baby on the left side of her body, and I videotaped her baby. I was looking at her baby's face and videotaping her baby. And over her shoulder. And the baby looked at the camera. Of course, the camera's interesting. Looked at the camera and also looked at her face and smiled. And she said, oh, the baby can see me and is looking at me. And I said, yes. And the baby was really interested in, you know, this camera, object coming over your shoulder. And that, you see, that changed how she related to her baby. Now, they knowing this, she would observe her baby and talk to her baby and wait for her baby to respond. So it was an important learning.
Yeah. Yeah. The mother is so important. That relationship between mother and baby is so primal, because they're together all the time, especially in the beginning and from the very beginning. And as a father, maybe an unenlightened father, I'm now going to confess that I sort of had this attitude that the baby wasn't really real until about 3 months. when they start to recognize me and respond to me.
Yeah.
And that's when I get really interested as a male, and I don't know how typical I am in that regard.
Well, let's offer a dad's wonderful experience. You know, tummy time is such a big issue. You know, lots of parents say, you know, my baby doesn't like being on their tummy. So one little activity for a baby to get comfortable on their tummy is for the parent. Let's say the dad lies down on the floor and places a pillow behind his head so his head is raised and gathers his baby on, and they're tummy to tummy now.
Okay.
So the baby's lying on his chest, and dad can hum to the baby. Now the baby feels these humming vibrations through the dad's chest, and very soothing to the baby. So this is kind of a comfortable way for babies to begin tummy time, and for dads to do something new with their baby that maybe they wouldn't have thought of, you know, and communicating, looking down at their baby.
Yeah.
And so I think, and also encouraging this tummy time early.
Yeah. And that certainly sounds familiar. I need to adjust the picture of myself and these babies. One memory that stands out really strongly. The twins actually came along late, and so I was older. I was an older father, and almost, and I had a different attitude about parenting, I think, because I was more secure in my career, et cetera, and because there were two, they sort of needed more attention. And so I remember one time when very early on, I mean, this was when they were really, really just not long out of the hospital. I don't know how many days, but it was pretty, they were quite little. And I'm sitting in a rocking chair, and I've got one on each
shoulder,
shoulder, breast, chest, something.
And
they're sleeping, and I'm in this rocking chair, and it's like I can feel their little consciousnesses pulling me down. And I'm getting sleepier and sleepier, and it's just such a wonderful feeling to feel these little these little sleeping beings. And that's one of the strongest memories of my life, really. There was a real deep bonding experience for me.
Yes. Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, where are we in our outline here? We were going to talk about developmental movement, social interaction, self-motivated learning. It feels like we've been doing all of those.
I think so. I think we went through the developmental movement and how important the motor development is and movement in all those domains, in social interaction. I mean, a baby will reach out and touch your face. And sometimes if you're close to your baby, say you're lying on the floor in playing beside your baby, if the baby is exploring a toy, they also may stay connected to you by placing their foot against you. You know, they like to keep that connection, or a hand on you. So their touch, and they will also reach, if you're close enough, maybe reach out and touch your face, right? So, yes, touch and being close to each other socially is really important, and that is movement. And even the little game that parents often play at the beginning, there's a lot of scientific research about tongue protrusion, and so sticking the tongue out. And but, you know, what's important is to wait for the baby to organize their response. Often as adults, I think we move a little too quickly, not waiting for the baby, giving the baby time to organize their response. So I think that's important.
Yeah, going back to the idea of the baby kind of taking the lead.
Yes.
Yeah.
Taking the lead.
Yeah, and being patient. And you really have to slow down to do this.
Yeah.
As an adult, you have to slow down and turn on your curiosity.
Yes.
And instead of
feel like the baby.
Yeah. Instead of feeling like, okay, this is dead time, but I have to spend time with my baby. I don't know if anybody's like that or not, but.
Yeah. I hope not.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, of course, there are times, I mean, parents are busy and, you know, would like to do other things, of course. But I really do encourage parents right from the beginning to set up an environment in your home. It doesn't have to be very large, large enough for two, right, on the floor, that is your place that you return to and that you can have these little social interactions and playtimes. You know, I think babies make adults and parents playful. And often, you know, parents need experience in play. Mm-hmm. They don't really know, you know, how to play with the baby. So to have this space in the home and a time, maybe they discover a special time of day. Maybe in the morning the baby is more alert, and maybe again later in the afternoon. You know, so that these times of days are just for you and your baby. And they don't have to be very long. You know, you may begin with 15 minutes, and then because you will become so interested and engaged with your baby, they expand. You maybe have a half an hour, you know, at different times during the day. But in those times, you have your attention is with your baby, not in being all these other different places and doing all different things.
You know, we think of babies demanding a lot of time and being the source of the occasion for a lot of work. But I think that also the baby is doing a lot for us, and that the baby potentially is a healer. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, I do think that, as I said, I think babies bring out a playfulness in adults that maybe they don't, you know, express any mm-hmm. other way, and a joy. You know, a joy that through their love, through this social interaction, that is absolutely, you could call it healing because it is love.
Where I'm coming from with that is I have a good friend who has suffered some neurological issues, and recently he's been visiting another friend who has a new baby. And he finds that he's actually going to hang out with the baby. He goes and visits so he can hang out with the baby, and he feels better mm-hmm. as a result.
Yes, of course.
So it sounds like it's a very healing interaction.
Yes, well, I mean, that's a very specific situation, right? I mean, I'm talking more generally about parents and grandparents and caregivers and babies.
Yeah.
But yes, I can certainly understand that, and gives them a lot of pleasure. So, and a lot of joy.
Yeah. What have we not touched on here that you'd really like to make sure that we get in, or have we touched on it all?
I think we've touched on a lot.
Earlier, you mentioned a video that you made, and I'm wondering, is that available for people? Is there some place where they can see this video?
Yes. Well, of course, my new book is available, and my first book. And my first book is based actually on the first video, Amazing Babies Moving and Amazing Toddlers Moving. So there are two videos that are available at my website.
And what is that website?
Is www.amazingbabiesmoving.com, and my new book is available at the book website www.yourselfmotivatedbaby.com. But I wanted to say that these videos my first book have been translated into four languages. The videos were translated and used as a parenting program on Hop Television in Israel for over 4 years. They're used in many educational programs and somatic programs, early childhood education, so Montessori and Waldorf, preschools.
Yeah, I'm not surprised, and that's going to be very gratifying.
Very gratifying. And I guess what I really want to emphasize, you know, by focusing on the first 6 months, is to look at the baby's motivation. The baby's motivation in social interactions and in actions in exploring the environment. And by also, looking at the videos and the vignettes, seeing how the baby explores for a very long time from initiating the exploration and completing the exploration in their own time.
Okay, well, maybe that's a good wrap-up. So, Beverly Stokes, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
And thank you. It was wonderful. I look forward to hearing it and possibly seeing it.
Okay.
Okay, David. Okay. Thank you very much.
One thing that we didn't discuss in the interview is that both of Beverly's books reference extensive research on infant and child development, and much of it directly supports the work she's doing. For example, she writes, and I quote, "My research on motivation in social and play interactions shows that the baby's early explorations right from birth have a much greater influence on their future development than previously thought," close quote. There's one study she cites in her book that I found particularly striking. She didn't want to discuss it in the interview, inasmuch as it's not research that she conducted herself. Nonetheless, she did cite it in her book, and I'd like to share that paragraph verbatim from her latest book, Your Self-Motivated Baby. She writes, and I quote, "In a groundbreaking 14-year large-scale longitudinal research study published in 2013, Mark Bornstein, head of child and family research at the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child and Health and Human Development, and his associates reported that infants they studied, who are more motorically mature and who explored more actively at 5 months, achieved higher academic levels when they were 14 years old. Based on their analysis of the results, they concluded that an infant's greater motor exploratory competency enables the infant to participate in more opportunities for social interaction and creates richer involvement with their environment. This forms the foundation for the development of better cognitive functioning during childhood and higher academic achievement in adolescence," close quote. As you know, I've been very excited by the growing neuroscience literature supporting the brain's involvement and the importance of the development of secure attachment in early childhood. It's clear that the parenting approach advocated by Beverly Stokes goes a long way toward the establishment of strong bonds. As she writes elsewhere, and I quote, "The National Scientific Council on the Developing Child at Harvard University reports that critical features of brain architecture are shaped by experience before and right after birth. For example, different capabilities in problem-solving and goal-directed actions. These self-initiated activities are the foundation for their social and cognitive development," end quote. I highly recommend her two books, especially the latest one, Your Self-Motivated Baby, for all parents of babies, as well as all students of human development. Her books can be found on Amazon.com, and you can use the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar to order them, and we'll get a small fraction of what you've spent to support Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi guys, my name is Tony. I'm from Melbourne, Australia, and I just signed up to become a monthly donator to Shrink Wrap Radio. And I did this because I love this podcast series. It gives me so much every single time I listen to these episodes, and I just wanted to give something back. I think it's important that when you find something that's pure of heart and honest in its intent and generous in its spirit, that you get behind and support it to ensure that it continues. And that's what I've done, and I encourage you all to do the same. Get on board, donate, put your hands in your pockets, stand up. It feels good. It's important. Thanks.
Tony, I really appreciate you as a donor, and you're stressing the importance of becoming a donor to those who have yet to follow your excellent example. I'm happy to announce that we do have one new donor since the last episode, and it's Marion Russo, PhD. Thank you, Marion. I'm also happy to announce that we do have a new transcript on the site. It's number 470, The Cycle of Life, with Israeli Jungian analyst Erel Shalit, thanks to Ellie Nobbs. Let me remind you to take our online poll. I've been putting up 5-minute or so video clips of some of my recent interviews, and I've started to make full-length videos of some of these interviews available on my Shrink Wrap Radio YouTube site. Up until quite recently, I assumed that my listeners would not be interested in full-length videos. Please let me know if that's an option you'd be likely to use. In fact, to make it easy for you, I've put up a poll in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Just scroll down past all the book ads, and you'll see the poll, which says, are you likely to go to my Shrink Wrap Radio YouTube site to see full-length videos of some of my interviews? And then you can answer either yes or no. So far, only about 7 people have answered that poll, so that's a pretty small sample, so I'm really hoping to get more involvement than that. Now, in case you haven't noticed, this is episode number 500 of Shrink Wrap Radio, which is a real milestone and probably should be celebrated somehow. If I had gotten it together, I would have thought to invite listeners to call in and leave a message on our answering machine or send a recording with a short congratulations about reaching this milestone. Actually, I think the interview that Australian listener and podcaster Amy Feldman did with me is a good milestone marker, inasmuch as she did a very good job of drawing me out about my podcasting adventure. You can find a link to both the audio and the video of that interview that she did with me on our site under the In the Media tab. Let me remind you that you can use the Amazon.com search widget in our right-hand sidebar to purchase more than just books. It's not for nothing that Amazon has been called the everything store. If you'll remember to go to our site and use that widget for all your Amazon purchases, it will really help us. I know many of you probably use Amazon regularly to purchase all sorts of things. And if you'll use the search tool in our widget, it will automatically add our affiliate code, and Shrink Wrap will get a small percentage of the purchase. It's just another way that you can help to support us. And in the left-hand sidebar on our site, you can click on special deals from Amazon. For example, you can save up to 90% on textbooks. You can get up to 40% off TurboTax. And there's a little box that has a different special from Amazon that changes every day.
Hi, this is journalist Jamal Yogis, author of The Fear Project. You're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Jamal Yogis, whom I interviewed back on episode number 334 about his book, The Fear Project. I really enjoyed both his book and the opportunity to interview him. Now let's go to a recent email from our listener community. Dear Dr. Dave, this is Leslie in Seattle. Recently in your commentary, parentheses, number 497, Tom Bird, close parentheses, you shared your dreams, anxieties, failures, and successes regarding the idea of writing a book. As a person who works with others struggling through all of those, the stages of authorship, you might say, I was touched by your story. Self-revelatory, self-accepting candor, in this case, your mention of the pipe-smoking, turtleneck-wearing, beatnik rider image you once held dear, is truly your signature and weapon of compassion. It catches people off guard, I think, and pierces them with their own humanity. For we all harbor dreams and anxieties that drive or thwart our plans, and when one demonstrates compassionate self-acceptance, it gives others inspiration to practice the same. To my ear, your openness always carries a note of disenchantment and benevolence, fed by a desire, I imagine, to help others avoid certain self or culture-imposed heartaches. Yours is, I think, a deeply generous voice. Hearing your reflections about writing compels me to share what I do for work and fun. I have a dual career. Part of the week, I'm a somatic therapist, over 30 years, and the rest of the time, since 2000, I'm an editor and book packager, from idea to product, for self-publishing or pre-publishing writers. A few years ago, I changed my book business name to Somatic Arts Editing, part of cultivating a clientele of writers in the field of somatic therapies. I also do business as Body Mind Books, same service, different name. Putting one's writing out into the world can be a profoundly vulnerable act of self-expression and trust. Add to that, when working with commercial publishers, one often steps from a private and comfortably self-paced process onto a treadmill of sanity-sucking deadlines and perceived editorial criticism that can reinforce self-loathing or even trigger old emotional traumas. My joy in what I do comes from helping to make those last steps, polishing and launching healing endeavors in their own right. As a practitioner of somatic experiencing, I value the rhythms inherent in our nervous systems, the organic intelligence that allows the emotional challenges writers face to become gateways instead of roadblocks. Out of that sensibility, I assist writers in creating schedules that are self-nurturing, processes that celebrate successes along the way, practices that fortify self-compassion and identity, and designs that are wholly expressive in explicit and nuanced ways of a person's creative and neurophysical integrity. I didn't mean to turn this thank you letter into a marketing pitch, but I suppose it serves as both. I thank you for the genuineness you model for your listeners, and I hope you keep my services on your radar for those who have, like you did, a dream of sharing their gifts through a book, and who also, like you, need to work through the complicated fears and desires that so often accompany such a dream. With regards from a regular listener, and that's from Leslie Elisle, I hope I pronounced that correctly, and you can find her website at Somatic Arts Editing and Capacity Somatic Health. Those are two of her websites. And Leslie, I hope you don't mind my taking the liberty of sharing your beautiful letter with my audience. I did send an email to Leslie asking if I could read this on the air, and I haven't heard back from her, but I took that liberty anyway, and I hope I don't get burned by my bravery. So all of you who are listening, if you write me, be aware that you are risking that I may read your email on the air. I don't guarantee that I will, but I don't promise that I won't unless you explicitly instruct me not to do that. So you're all forewarned about this. And first of all, Leslie, you are such a beautiful writer yourself. So right away, I think that qualifies you to consult with other writers. And I also want to thank you very much for your kind observations about me and my style. I think you're spot on. So thanks for taking the time to share all of that. And I hope that my reading your email might bring you some business as well. And I'll definitely keep you in mind. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app to make a recording that I'll get. Thanks to today's guest, Beverly Stokes, for sharing her work on infant development through movement. My next guest will be New York-based psychoanalyst Dr. Ann Chandler, and we'll be speaking about mindfulness and relationship enmeshment. You don't normally hear those two phrases back to back, so I think she's going to have some interesting information for us. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.